You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, December 19th, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Nancy Fraser, professor of political and social science at the New School for Social Research, author of Cannibal Capitalism, How Our System is Devouring Democracy, Care, and the Planet, and What We Can Do About It. Also on the program today, I'm back. Back from a cruise. Talk about that, maybe. Also, the January 6th committee to refer Trump criminal charges to the DOJ. Meanwhile, the Ways and Means Committee votes tomorrow on whether to release Trump's taxes. D.C. Federal Appellate Court denies Republican push to extend Title 42. That's going to go to the Supreme Court. El Paso mayor, meanwhile, declares a state of emergency over the increase in migrants. North Carolina Supreme Court strikes down voter ID and the North Carolina gerrymander just as court flips over to Republican control. Elon Musk loses a poll that he posted about whether he should continue running Twitter.
He lost the original poll and then the runoff poll.
Yeah, there were two previous polls. Yeah. You missed this, yes.
Oh my God.
And he goes, oh, the phrasing's wrong. Sorry, new poll.
Too many options.
Let's and then he lost
two.
The second
and then he lost the two.
Republican who flipped a Democratic seat in New York, a congressional seat, the 3rd District, apparently completely fictionalized his resume. Kudos,
American
New
dream.
York Democrats, well done. Government runs out of money on Friday as Congress races to pass a funding bill. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Beginning of the week. I am back from my week on the high seas. First off, I want to thank Emma Vigeland, my co-host, for filling in.
Of course.
While I was testing out whether I was going to become a merchant marine. And It's actually looking good.
Yeah, shockingly so.
Is it looking good, or did you not understand that the commissary was available for you without money and did not know that the shops were duty-free?
Yeah.
There was a couple of things that I did not learn until like the last day that I was there.
Tough merchant marining.
I was...
I did not take advantage.
I was... I was surviving on the cookies that were available right before the panels.
Yeah.
Like, literally. And I thought I was saving a couple of bucks. I don't know what I thought. Like, I was like, I had a feeling that there was, like, free food somewhere, and I just didn't, I didn't put it all together. I was a little overwhelmed by all of the stuff on the boat. And so, but I did... Well, we'll talk more about it in the fun half, because we don't want to hold up things. But thank you, Emma. I heard very good things, although I didn't have much of an internet access on the boat.
Oh,
it was
okay.
Very, very thin. And then, like, at one point, I got a message from AT&T because I guess I had my data roaming on. And
another
I got very scared.
Way that you did not financially
not
take
the great
advantage
merchant marine,
of
yeah.
the... right. You are no. A merchant marine, you are not.
No. No. But and also, I'm still dealing with, like, I guess I have sea legs because I'm still, like, a little dizzy. So apparently on a ship, it's called mess deck, not the... it's the Lido deck. So... I knew that from watching Love Boat. as a kid, which nobody knows what I'm talking about here.
No.
Wow. All right.
Sorry.
That's a little disturbing. Okay, let's move on to this. Today, the January 6th panel is meeting, I think, at 1 p.m. to make some criminal referrals, I should say, to the DOJ. Among them will be criminal referrals of Donald Trump for inciting insurrection at the Capitol on January 6th. I don't anticipate the DOJ doing much about it. Even if they were, they're going to run out of time. But as a political matter and as an accountability matter, it's an important thing to note. On top of which, I think it's quite possible tomorrow we will see the Ways and Means Committee vote to release the Trump taxes that we've heard so much about for the past, I guess, 6 years.
Yeah.
Or we've not heard so much about for the past 6 years, the specifics. And, of course, there is this incredible desire amongst the media to presume that Donald Trump is going to now go away.
I'm trying to will it into existence.
There was a poll that came out, which I did see while I was on the high seas, that showed close to 50-50 split. I can't remember the exact numbers in terms of whether Democrats wanted Joe Biden to run again. But 65-35% Republicans wanted Trump to run again.
Mm-hmm. And there was a CNBC poll that we covered that showed that like something like 60% of Americans don't want Trump to run again. It said 70% of Americans didn't want Biden.
Right. I mean, so, you know, there's this sort of like aspirational quality that we see on the news in terms of talking about Donald Trump. But CNN brought out a Republican to say that Trump's time is over. But of course, in fact, it's this Republican who is really no longer an elected official or won't be in a month or two.
His time is over.
Indeed.
It's not hard to figure out what one man you're talking about there. Do you think Republicans are increasingly receptive to that message? Do you think Donald Trump's hold on your party is finally slipping?
Absolutely, I do. First, I think his influence was waning, not as quickly as I had hoped it would, but I think it was waning. But the election outcome from last month, I think, dramatically accelerates the waning. And frankly, his unbelievably terrible rollout of his election campaign is also not helping him. So yeah, I mean, I think you see it manifested in a number of ways. One obvious way was quite an impressive turnout of prominent Republicans who have been going to events like the RJC meeting in Las Vegas, openly talking about themselves as candidates after Donald Trump had already made it clear he was running. So it tells you that they perceive the Republican electorate to be much more open. And in my travels since the election around Pennsylvania, I've heard from many, many formerly very pro-Trump voters that they think it's time for our party to move on. So yes, I think that process is underway. It's not a flip of a switch. Doesn't happen overnight. Nope. He still has a significant following, that's for sure. I do think his influence is waning. Let's talk about the Republican.
Right. I mean, this is it may be the case that his influence is waning as opposed to when he was president of the United States. But still, there's absolutely no reason to believe that when a primary happens, in the event that any of these people even run, that he's not going to do the same thing he did in 2015, 2016 mm-hmm. amongst the same candidates that were there. I mean, it's not like, you know, Ron DeSantis, I would say, is, you know, not too dissimilar from Rudy Giuliani or Scott Walker, for that matter. Everybody thought going in, or Chris Christie, everybody thought Scott Walker was going to be the guy. He dropped out almost first. When Giuliani was going in, they thought, oh, he's America's mayor. It turns out not really America's mayor. And so there's just this incredible sense of of aspiration.
Yeah, I may be waning, but you guess what you guys aren't doing is waxing. You're not waxing.
Not waxing.
Not waxing enough. And in terms of what is old being new again, Pat Toomey there doing the Jeff Flake, right? Yeah. There's always this guy, retiring, outgoing Republican. The fever's breaking. The fever's breaking this time.
Not so much. All right. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Nancy Fraser, professor of political and social science at the New School, author of Cannibal Capitalism. But first, a couple of words from our sponsors. One of our sponsors today, Aura. When you sign up for Aura and you test out your emails to see if something's been, if somebody's got your passwords or anything like that, it immediately comes back and says, okay, you've signed up for these websites and there was a data leak. And what's also incredibly helpful to me is that, like, I found, not only did I find with one of my emails, I have many emails, a bunch of data leaks, but I didn't even know I had signed up for Architizer. I don't know what it is. It's like some type of architecture tool. And I don't know what happened. Like, it was like one of those, like, 3 a.m. and I'm like, maybe I should become an architect, or I have no idea what it was. But I found out that I had signed up for it, and I then, like, canceled my account and changed my passwords. But Aura does a bunch of other things, too. It helps you fight back against those annoying websites that make your personal information public, because they automatically request removal of your info. And then you get less robocalls, less junk mail, less people snooping around, doxing you on Twitter, following your personal jet. I don't know about that part. Aura protects you from scammers and hackers, like I say, by scanning the dark web. That's where criminals sell stolen information. And not only, like I say, do you find out whether your emails and passwords have been compromised, but also your social security numbers, as well as, like, your family's social security numbers, like your kids. And then it alerts you fast if it finds anything. Or it gives you near real-time alerts on suspicious credit inquiries, like if someone was opening a loan or a credit card in your name. Last week, or I guess, I don't know, was it a month ago? It was a month ago. Opened up a savings account for Myla, one that she could have access to. She doesn't know about the secret ones I have for her. I got a notice. Somebody opened up a new bank account. Fortunately, it was me, but
still good to know.
Good to know. They're on top of it. Or it's got a VPN that allows you to stay anonymous online by keeping your browsing history and your personal information safe and encrypted. Aura protects your devices from viruses, malware, spyware. Aura helps you manage what your kids can do on their devices. You restrict specific apps. You set screen time limits. You say, dude, you can't watch more YouTube than this. And then you just walk away, and it does it automatically. Aura's password manager lets you store and access your online passwords securely and conveniently. And here's the best part. You can try Aura for free for 14 days at aura.com/majority. You're going to be shocked how much your private information Aura finds exposed online over the next 2 weeks during your free trial. Well, hopefully not. Hopefully you'll have none, but you may. That's A-U-R-A, aura.com/majority. Try Aura for free for 14 days. And also sponsoring the program today, end of the year, holiday season, people are looking to make donations. When you want to make a donation to a charity, you also want to make sure that your donations are making a big impact, that the charity is on the level, that dollar for dollar, your dollars are really doing something. And you could go out, you could research these charities, God bless, but a lot of work. Or what you could do is visit givewell.org, and there you're going to find free research and recommendations about the charities that can save or improve lives the most per dollar. GiveWell spends over 30,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only directs funding to a few of the highest impact, evidence-backed opportunities they've found. Over 100,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $1 billion. Rigorous evidence suggests these donations are going to save over 150,000 lives and improve the lives of millions more. And this, and what is amazing about this is GiveWell's research is free. GiveWell wants as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about high-impact giving. They publish all of their research recommendations on their site for free. No sign-up required. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity or fund you choose without even taking a cut. This is where, I don't know, GiveWell advertised with us, I guess, a couple of years ago. And I use their site, and that's where, I mean, I've found other charities on there, but now my go-to charity is GiveDirectly. It has no relationship to GiveWell, just happens to have the word give in it. And GiveDirectly, you know, we've raised some money for on this program. But when I give money to GiveDirectly, I go through GiveWell, because that, by doing so, their donors continue to support this work, which is really, really helpful in terms of finding charities that you know are going to have the most impact. If you've and during this year, if you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you could have your donation matched up to $100 before the end of the year, as long as matching funds last. To claim your match, go to GiveWell.org, pick podcast, enter the Majority Report at checkout. Make sure that I know you heard about GiveWell from the Majority Report, and they will match your donation as long as those funds last. Check it out, GiveWell.org. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Nancy Fraser, professor of political and social science at the New School for Social Research, about her latest, Cannibal Capitalism, How Our System is Devouring Democracy, Care and the Planet, and what we can do about it. We'll be right back after this. We are back, Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us for the first time, I believe, Nancy Fraser. She is a professor of political and social science at the New School for Social Research, author of Cannibal Capitalism, How Our System is Devouring Democracy, Care, and the Planet, and What We Can Do About It. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So, all right, let's start with the argument that you're making that that we are facing multiple crises across our society, and how that would lead to an expanded conception of capitalism.
Yeah, exactly. I think we're in a very rare moment historically of a severe crisis, the sort of crisis that historians would call a general crisis, meaning it's not confined to one sector. It's not only an economic crisis or only an ecological crisis or only a political crisis, but it's all of that rolled into one. So it's a crisis that is engulfing the whole social order. Now, I think that what lies at the bottom of this crisis are some deep irrationalities that are hardwired into our social structure, which is a capitalist social structure. But familiar views of capitalism focus one-sidedly on its economic dimension, and they would generally direct our attention to looking at the economic aspect of the crisis.
You're talking about a Marxist critique.
Exactly. Marxist or social democratic, left-wing theories derived from Marx and in softer or harder forms, let's say. The problem is those theories have tended to be too economy-focused. They haven't been expanded to take in other crisis tendencies, other contradictory and perverse aspects of capitalism, those which lead it periodically to ecological crises, to social crises, and to political crises. So what my book does is try to develop a different and larger view of what capitalism is that shows how it is primed, hardwired, to generate not just periodic economic crises, but general crises of the sort we're facing now, which also include these other dimensions.
Okay, so let's talk about these other dimensions and the crises that are contained there, and then I just want to go a little bit deeper into how these different sectors and which make up this general crisis, how they essentially broadly constitute capitalism. But let's start with these various sectors. I guess we could start with the economy. Outline for us the crisis that we have in this economy.
Well, I would say overall, understood in the most human way, which is the way we should be thinking about it, it's a massive deterioration in the conditions of life that the overwhelming majority of people on the planet are facing. Either because their livelihoods are imperiled, because the work does not pay a living wage, certainly not a wage on which you could support a family. And so people are driven into debt, and that creates a whole new wonderful set of profit opportunities for now not the manufacturers, but for the banking and financial sector. So we've had the offshoring of production to low-wage regions. We've had the weakening of unions, which were the only institutions that, you know, in our country managed to support the claims of working people for decent wages. We've got the precarization of work. No more, like, lifelong secure jobs, you know, that you could build a life with some predictability around. Jobs that can disappear in a flash and that usually get replaced by even more insecure, precarious, and even less well-paid jobs. So people are having to moonlight, that you have to cobble together an income based on a whole set of different streams. Different family members contributing if you have a family with more than one adult. And, you know, it's kind of a big hot mess for the majority of people who do not have independent sources of family wealth or property ownership. And this is the case in the United States, which has always thought of itself as a relatively wealthy country. But think about the other parts of the world that, you know, have never thought of themselves as wealthy and that are equally suffering from being more or less expelled from the official circuits of economic exchange and production. More and more people are thrust outside of all that without much hope of ever finding a way in. It's from an economic point of view, it's a mess.
Okay, and let's talk about social reproduction. And just, you know, for those who haven't, who aren't familiar with the term, explain to us what social reproduction is, and how in this era where it's in crisis.
Exactly. I think people who may not know this technical term, social reproduction, will know what I'm talking about if I talk about a crisis of care or a care crunch. We hear a lot about family work imbalance and so on. Now, what I've just said about the crisis of work, that all pertains to paid work. But there's a whole nother fund of work that's absolutely essential in a capitalist society, which is largely unpaid. And that is the work of care or social reproduction. That is the birthing, the raising, the socializing of children, the new generations of workers. It's the replenishing and restoring of existing workers who have to be fed and cleaned and rested and so on in order to continue work. It's care for the elderly, for community, family, and friends. Now, that work has traditionally been done for the most part, not exclusively, but for the most part by women. It's gendered work. You know, care, that's a feminine thing, supposedly, in our way of thinking. But nowadays, women have been drawn into the paid workforce, partly because of what I said before, the destruction of the idea of a family wage in which a man, let's say, could earn enough to support the whole family without a working wife. Okay, that kind of system is gone. And instead, women's wage work is essential, both for the profit makers, for the corporate sector, which needs it, and for the families who rely on that income. Well, that means that the time, the energy, and so on that was required before for this contribution, this essential contribution in care work, is being siphoned off to the corporate sector, to the profit sector. And add to that, that there's been pressure from investors on states, on governments, to cut back social spending. All this talk about the deficit and so on. So we have the contraction of social services at just the moment when women have less time to devote to care work privately. All of the state supports for care in the form of daycare, childcare, elder care, health care, all of these things are under pressure. It's a perfect storm of social reproductive crisis. Where is the energy? Where is the time? Where is the revenue that's going to support this going to come from?
Where do we see the implications? I mean, is that in we have children that maybe are entering into a school with more of a vocabulary deficit, or we're seeing people who are you know, having to go into nursing homes before maybe prematurely because there is no ability to care for them at home. Where do we see, where does this manifest itself in terms of like, I understand the concept of the stress that's associated with it, but where do we see those outcomes?
Well, frankly, in a whole lot of ways, I think even, although this might, I couldn't spell this out quickly. I think even in decline in life expectancy, actually, in certain sectors of the population because of, you know, just being socially cut off, let's yep. say, not being touched even, you know, things like that. But also just think about the institutional side of this. Look at what goes on in nursing homes, in hospitals, in schools. Huge class size in schools because we're not putting the money into that. I just had a friend who had a hip replacement who at one of the premier hospitals in New York City who actually spent the night on a gurney in a hallway because they didn't have a bed for him. This kind of stuff is happening more and more. Nurses have caseloads that exceed their capacity to actually do their job. This is all part of this crisis of care, because care is not only done in the private home or in the community, but also in these institutions that require public support as well as private investments of time and energy.
You write, too, that we're facing a crisis of the environment. I think that's hopefully people are, you know, it's self-explanatory. Right. I mean, I think that hopefully the people understand that one third of Pakistan was underwater recently. We've had massive drought for years out in the west coast of this country. We've seen it, you know. We can see it everywhere. I mean, around the world. Well, talk about the crisis in the context of politics that we're facing.
I think there are two dimensions of this. One is that a capitalist economy, in order to function the way it's supposed to, requires public powers. It requires public goods, infrastructure, roads, bridges, tunnels, and now, as we know, a broadband. And we even talk about the care infrastructure, which was discussed a while back in the Congress. It requires regulatory capacity, right? Because, you know, capitalists need sometimes to be disciplined for their own good. They would often put the thirst for short-term profit over a longer-term sustainable economic system. So it's kind of like Ulysses. You have to tie them to the mast so that they won't destroy their own profit system. What I'm saying then is that, hang on a second, I've sort of lost my thread here.
We have two aspects of our crisis in politics.
Regulatory capacity and public good infrastructure, at least. There are other things too. Legitimacy, credibility. I mean, think about the Supreme Court now, the possibility of its loss of legitimacy. So there's a tendency to hollow out the public powers that the system needs because corporations and investors don't want to pay for it. They don't want to pay the taxes that all of this requires to support it. And they want to capture the regulatory agencies, put their own lobbyists in there. We know about the revolving door, people who work in the public agencies and then leave and go right back to corporate jobs, the very corporations they were supposed to be overseeing, right? So there's regulatory capture, and there is essentially the loss of legitimacy. All of this means that we actually don't have the public powers that we need to rein in corporate power. And if we don't have that at the national level, we certainly don't have it at the transnational and global level, because after all, we have problems that can't be solved at the national level. We have some problems that require larger public powers, climate change, public health in an age of pandemic, and mm-hmm. so on and so forth. So, and we don't have the public powers there that the investors, the mega corporations, they know how to offshore and jurisdiction shop. They find ways to escape the state powers that try to constrain them. And out there, beyond the states, it's a no man's land where they can sort of do what they want. So that's one aspect. But there's also a second, and this I would call, to use another technical term, the hegemonic dimension of crisis, meaning loss of legitimacy, loss of credibility. When governance doesn't work, when people feel their governments can't solve their problems or won't solve their problems, even if they could, then they start to lose faith in the system and they start looking for alternatives. That's the situation we're in now, I think, politically. It's why the mainstream public parties have lost a lot of their support. It's why people are gravitating to more radical, even out-of-the-box ways of thinking. In some cases, those out-of-the-box ways of thinking are actually promising and could lead to a what I would call a progressive or an emancipatory restructuring of the system, which I'd be all in favor of. But plenty of the alternatives that people are trying out today are really noxious.
And if you look internationally, I think we're as well as in this country, there's a pretty pronounced trend towards that more noxious version of authoritarianism and revanchism that we're seeing across the globe. All right. So those are the areas in which we're facing these crises. And we should say that these crises are also from the perspective of the capitalist system. They're crises that we're not observing these crises as a critique of capitalism as much as it is it's a problem that even for capitalism itself, we should say. I mean, that's the cannibalistic quality of this. It's almost like beyond cannibalism when the snake starts eating its own tail on some level. Let's just take this moment to sort of like place where we are in terms of capitalism that has brought us to this point, because we are living in an era of capitalism that is may have been sort of a natural progression of capitalism, but we place it in context and sort of like temporally to get a notion of it, and then. Yeah. As a way of also introducing the idea of what happens next with capitalism, or the different possibilities of what happens next.
Great. Yeah. I mean, I should start by saying that all of the crisis forms that we've been discussing, all of the aspects of crisis, are happening in a way that is non-accidental. They are happening not in spite of, but because of, the system's inherent dynamics and structure. That's important. That means that every form of capitalism will have some kind of a tendency to crisis. Now, that doesn't mean that the crisis always becomes severe, like at the present. But the tendency is there. And that brings me to your point about the history. How do we understand what the present form of capitalism is in relation to past forms? And I would say that this is more or less the fourth phase in the history of capitalism. We had, first of all, a form of mercantile capitalism in the 16th through 18th centuries. That's the period in which European wealth went abroad and conquered the so-called New World and instituted slavery and so on and so forth. Then we got the rise of industrial capitalism in the 19th century. And that's, we now see with the benefit of hindsight, that's the invention of the steam engine of mass production industry, the beginning of fossil capitalism, and hence the beginning of the greenhouse gas crisis that we're now living from. Then we got an attempt to correct that, to tame the system in so-called social democratic or New Deal capitalism. That comes in the interwar period in the United States and in the post-war period in much of Europe. And by the way, that coincides with decolonization and the attempt in the ex-colonial world to build build developmental states that would also try to soften the hard edges of capitalism by using state power. Now, that was until, let's say, the 1970s. It's been called the Golden Age. The French call it the 30 glorious years of capitalism. Basically, that began unraveling in the 1970s as corporations staged what has now become a successful revolt against the regulations, against the softening efforts to use state power, right, to tame capitalism. They revolted against that and essentially have given us neoliberal capitalism. This is what neoliberalism means. And that it has put those inherent crisis tendencies always involved in capitalism, that has put them on steroids. It has brought that these contradictions to a fever pitch in every sector that we've talked about, in social reproduction, in the political sector, in the economic sector, and in the ecological sector. Neoliberalism has sharpened capitalism's inherent contradictions to the breaking point, and that's where we are now.
And COVID really highlights this, right? I mean, like the failure or the inability for our institutions to actually rein in the beast that is capitalism, because transnationally we were unable to really effectively address COVID without having someone like Bill Gates come in and essentially say, well, we're going to hoard this vaccine IP. I mean, in terms of an example that touches on all of those points that you laid out there, COVID is a great one, unfortunately.
I think that's absolutely true. I think you can see every strand of our current crisis all sort of converging in this pandemic moment that we've just lived through and are, I guess, still living through. First of all, there's the ecological strand, because where did the COVID virus come from? It came from species being brought close to each other that had previously never connected, so that the viruses that had been in the bats forever were able to leap to other species and then from them to us. And what brought all these species into contact? Global warming and the destruction of rainforests and other forms of development in pursuit of profit, right? Which destroyed habitats and caused mass species migrations. So I think the ecological is very closely related to the epidemiological. And we are going to see more epidemics and pandemics because of destruction of rainforest and because of ongoing greenhouse gas emissions and planetary heating. That's going to happen. Okay, but then there's the question of what are the resources that we have to deal with it? And you're absolutely right. The political side of this becomes important, because if we had had robust public health infrastructure and robust transnational health infrastructure and governance capacity, we could have done a lot better than we did. I think the result was going to be bad in any case, mm-hmm. but we could have done a hell of a lot better if we had had those resources. But neoliberalism had hollowed out those resources, had privatized much of our prior public health infrastructure. And today, the majority of capacity that we have available on the planet for health is in the hands of private, profit-oriented corporations who care nothing about the public good, who care about their profits. And of course, we know the scandal of therapeutics and vaccines being unavailable to large parts of the globe, even though that's going to hurt the wealthy regions who do have them as well in the long run. We know that. The irrationality is mind-boggling. But then look at the social reproduction dimension. That's there as well, because what did we see in COVID during lockdown? How the whole sort of care thing got reprivatized into the world of family, and how impossible it was for that to go on there, given, you know, with kids being trying to do remote schooling, what a disaster that was. People who were lucky enough to do remote work, and not everyone was, still having to multitask like crazy. Then the so-called essential workers who had to be out there on the front lines in very unsafe conditions without the resources to refuse and demand safe conditions, without unions to back them, you know, without labor rights or a federal labor bureaucracy to support them. So, you know, all of that, the care side of this was a disaster as well. And then, you know, the other thing, back to the economic, I would say, you know, capitalism prides itself. Its ideologues tell us that there's nothing like the market to tell you the true value of everything. You know, whatever the market says, that's what things are really valued as. Well, this pandemic showed how false that idea is, because we talked about essential work and we saw what work was essential to actually keep us alive and more or less functioning in under pandemic conditions. And yet we know that those workers doing that essential work were treated as totally disposable. They were exposed to disease. They were paid a pittance. So there's a lesson here, and that labor markets do not actually value things at their true worth. We need other social mechanisms to ensure that everyone is justly compensated for what they contribute. I think that there's a sense in which the COVID pandemic was a kind of textbook lesson in how irrational capitalism is as a social system. But are we going to learn that lesson and do something about it? That remains to be seen.
Even in the classification of essential workers, right? One is essential to, combating the pandemic, nurses, doctors, et cetera. But there also was the classification of essential workers for, and we just had an interview last week about this, that were lumped in with that, which is just essential to keeping capitalism functioning in a way that that keeps the wheels churning. And they were put on the front lines and yet deemed essential. And there was a conflation of those two things and not clarity about who was essential to keeping, like, people alive and who was essential to keeping profits up.
You know, I think that's a really interesting point. I would add that the Amazon warehouse pickers, the UPS drivers, the hospital cleaners, the grocery store clerks, they were essential. It's true that they were also keeping the profits going, but they were essential. I mean, how could the rest of us who were lucky enough to be locked down at home survive without those grocery deliveries and so on and so forth? They were essential too, but that was the lower end of the spectrum. The healthcare professionals were certainly essential, the trained doctors, nurses, and so on. But there's this other sort of more working class face, the non-professional face. And those are the ones that I was saying are essential, but are not really valued by capitalist labor markets.
They were treated as expendable.
Exactly.
Right.
So we have these crises, and I should say that because I'm getting corrected by our chat the way I'm saying
still crises. On vacation.
Yes, exactly. But this, and we don't know whether what we're looking at is a developmental in terms of how these crises will impact capitalism versus epochal, in that we're at the end of the line, or maybe not. I mean, because capitalism has a long history of sort of making some changes and heading into a new phase that addresses these, or at least sort of, I guess, lets the air out of the tires, as it were, for a certain period of time. Why is it important for us to understand capitalism beyond the Marxist, beyond the economic essentialism that we sometimes see in Marxism? Like, why is it important for us to see all of these elements to be indicative of capitalism?
Right. You know, I think it's related to the first part of what you said. What are the possible resolutions here? One resolution would be a new form of capitalism, hopefully kinder, gentler, or possibly worse. Another possible resolution is some kind of a post-capitalist society. Again, could be a better one, could be a very authoritarian, nasty one. I guess a third possibility is a slow unraveling and descent into war against all and barbarism of some kind. But let's hope we can avoid that. The point is, for any real significant change, you need a broad set of social forces, a political bloc in which a lot of people who are not necessarily exactly in the same boat, who don't have exactly the same priorities, can nevertheless come together and form a political force that has enough power and enough vision to insist on a big societal transformation, hopefully one for the good. What that means is that we have to think about how to construct a political bloc that can encompass a lot of different social movements, a lot of different political orientations. I'm talking now about the ones that most of us would assume would be progressive and potentially emancipatory. That means overcoming the dispersal and fragmentation of the mobilizations that we now see, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, Sanders campaign, you know, et cetera, et cetera. My thought here is that by showing that the various problems that different groups of us experience, which differ from one another, all have roots in one and the same social system. And it's not until we restructure that social system, we transform that social system, that we'll get to the root of any of this. So my idea is that it's not about saying everyone should forget about the fact that their children are being murdered in the streets by police and jump on the ecological bandwagon, or everyone should stop worrying about sexual assault and sexual harassment and start worrying about police violence. All of these things are urgent. It's not about telling people, ranking them, that the economy is more important than climate, or that climate is more important than care, or whatever. It's about showing that all of these problems, as I just said, can be traced to the dynamics of one social system, and that is capitalism, and especially the current neoliberal form of capitalism. And then on that basis, forming a kind of anti-capitalist front, we can be open about what exactly that will mean. We want to replace it. Not everyone may share the exact same picture of what a post-capitalist world, or even whether we're looking going to end up with kinder, gentler capitalism. I'm skeptical of that option, but I'm perfectly willing to be in alliance with people who still hope for that. In other words, what I'm saying is that by expanding our view of capitalism beyond the economic to take in these other dimensions of the crisis, we have a better chance of constructing the broad kind of alliance, the broad kind of political front that we need to do something about it.
Okay. And so if the idea is, you know, by expanding our definition of capitalism and these multiple crises, that we will find more allies, essentially. What is the limiting principle? I mean, because you talk about, you know, and should there be one as we go out and look for allies? You talk about the different types of populism, or the two types of populism, sort of the left and the right, and the left having a binary notion of what we're dealing with in terms of populism, and the right having a tripartite version. And then also the way that the left and the right define their enemies is different. Is that will you walk us through those? And is that the sort of the limiting principle? Is that where we know not? This gives us the lines to know where we don't look for allies, or is that, or is it that we're trying to change the way that those who look at the tripartite version of populism adopt the binary? But walk us through those, and then yeah, answer. I don't mean to put that all together.
A great question. What I said before about the people losing faith in the established parties and political leaders and so on, looking for the out of the box. That's what has given us left populism versus the right populism. In the United States, we can say Sanders versus Trump if we go back to 2016, which was when this all exploded. And yes, I think that if you think about what the difference between those two, some of their language overlapped, right? Both of them talked about a rigged system, and that was very interesting. And that word rigged is such a powerful word. It really resonated with many, many people who had been feeling for a long time that, you know, that they were being sort of played for suckers in our whole form of life here. What's the difference, though? Basically, I think that if we talk about Trumpism, for example, right-wing populism, I think that their picture of society is that there are the good, real Americans, the virtuous people that are caught between two blood-sucking enemies, right? The wealthy bi-coastal elites at the top and the immigrants, the Mexicans, the Blacks, the Jews, you know, the scapegoats du jour, all of them. And those people are sucking, you know, preying on the virtuous people caught in the middle. That's their map of what how society looks. Three levels. I think left-wing populism is much simpler. I think it only has two levels. It has the elites or the capitalist class or whatever language you want to use, the corporate class, let's say.
The 1%. The 1%.
Perfect. And then it has basically the people is understood much more broadly because many, many people are preyed upon by that 1%. It's not just those in the middle. It's not just those at the bottom. And the advantage of that is that it opens the possibility of that broader alliance of the bottom, the middle, and so on against the very top. That was the whole genius of the language of 99% versus 1%, which is sociologically imprecise, but rhetorically genius, I think. Okay, so that's one aspect of it. The other aspect that you mentioned is how are the enemies conceived in each of the two maps, the right populist versus the left populist. And I would say that the right populist, it's very concrete. They want to characterize people in an ethnic way, in terms of color, in terms of religion, cultural concreteness. When you say that the problems are the immigrants, the Mexican rapists, the Jews who cannot replace us, et cetera, we are talking in very concrete terms. Left-wing populism is more abstract. It refers to Wall Street. It refers to the 1%, as you just said. These are terms that don't say much about the specific identities or cultural profiles of the people, but they talk about the function of those people within the society. That's much better. Look, Wall Street can slide into international Jewish conspiracy. We know the history. I'm not saying that it's impervious, but still, it's a lot better to talk about Wall Street or Silicon Valley than to talk about Mexicans or Jews. And
the left can conceive of a someone who can betray their class because they're talking about the function. They can betray, you know, a Wall Streeter can betray their fellow Wall Streeters because of their function, as opposed to, like, you don't hear the concept of like, this is the one good immigrant. I mean, you know, maybe there's some good ones in there, you know, that type of thing. But there's no, you can't, you're an immigrant. Or you're not. It is that much more concrete in it, of an identity rather than the function that you're serving.
Exactly. And it's much harder to separate the person from the identity than it is the person from the function. I completely agree with you. And that's why I think that even though, as I say, I don't consider left-wing populism the end-all and be-all, I hope it would serve as a transition to something like democratic socialism. But nevertheless, it's a lot. It's far superior. It's far more sociologically correct in a way. It's not Jews who are sucking the blood. It is the corporate sector and the financial sector. And these are not the same thing. So this is a lot better. And I want to come to the second part of your question, though, because you asked how should the left look at those people who are now attracted to right-wing populism? Should we simply write them off and exclude them? And I would say not exactly. I want to introduce a distinction. I think that on that the right-wing populist movement, such as it is, includes people whom I would call principled racists, whom I want nothing to do with, and a much larger number of people I would call opportunistic racists, people who will vote for a racist who talks a good class line when there's no other alternative on the ballot who's talking a good class line. So we know, for example, that lots of people who eventually voted for Trump, especially in the upper Midwest, had once voted for Obama when he was on the ballot for Sanders in the Democratic primary. This shows me that these people are not principled racists, but opportunistic racists. And I think that the left strategy should be one of splitting. Two splits we have to make. One, we have to split the right-wing populist bloc and get rid of the principled racists on one side and the corporate elites who play a big role in manipulating that side of populism, okay? And woo, or try to win the other component of that right-wing populism. I also think we need to split the other side. And the other side I've called progressive neoliberalism. That might sound like a contradiction in terms, but I think it's a real thing. I think it's the sort of the Clinton wing, let's say, of the Democratic Party that basically incorporated a lot of sort of mainstream feminism, mainstream anti-racism, mainstream LGBTQ political forces, and hook them up with this regressive pro-Wall Street, pro-Silicon Valley, pro-Hollywood political economy. So it was an anti-working class, an unholy alliance of sort of liberal, the meritocratic liberal wings of social movements and the sort of cosmopolitan sector of the capitalist class. And I want to split them too. I want us to win the feminists, the anti-racists, the LGBTQ forces away from that unholy alliance with corporate capital. And I think that Sanders was trying to do something like this. I don't want to idealize his campaigns. They weren't perfect. But I think he had something like that double splitting strategy. We have right-wing populism. We have progressive neoliberalism. Let's try to build the third thing, call it left-wing populism or democratic socialism.
Is part of the challenge there that, because to the extent that we saw that separation between the opportunistic racists and the principled racists, if you will, and I think we can argue as to, like, really what constitutes the greater faction in that coalition. But assuming that there's ample amounts of both, to the extent that we saw any of that split happen, though, it seems to me that the people who were peeled off, to a large extent, are sort of the same type of people who have on the nominal, you know, center left, are that same sort of like ilk of like people who have married that anti-racism, let's call it, with some type of like corporate or neoliberal vision, right? Like we peeled off, in terms of, let's say, Biden, peeled off a lot of like suburban voters who were just sort of turned off by how gross Donald Trump was in those different ways. And it seems to me that if we were to probably look at an analysis of them, they're more college educated, more likely to be, broadly speaking, in that sort of corporate world, and sort of in that financialized world. Is that a dilemma?
Yeah, that would be a dilemma if it were not also possible to peel off. I mean, I'm the more, let's call them working class sectors, and I don't just mean the white working class. I mean the whole working class, which includes immigrants, including Hispanics, who are now tending to vote more Republican than they did previously. I'm trying to imagine a coalition that is sort of working class centered, but also attracts more educated people who you can call them traitors to their class or whatever, but who feel that they don't have a future in this society. And, you know, young people are extremely important. In every period, it's always the young people who are out in the forefront of new progressive forms of social struggle. And look what's happening to the generation of recent college graduates. I see it in with my graduate students. They will not have the kind of lives I've been privileged to have, where they're going to become a tenured professor with a lifelong career in something they love. That's not going to happen for 99% of them. So these people who might, if you take them in terms of who their parents are, you might think of as headed up that professional ladder, they're in a different situation. And I think I would like to expand our idea of what counts as the working class. Right? That includes professionals. That includes teachers, nurses, all kinds of people, not just truck drivers and coal miners, and hopefully we'll have less coal miners in the future. But, you know.
Some of the so-called PMCs, perhaps, exactly, on some level.
Exactly.
And I guess it also, I mean, there was just you guys just, a strike was settled at the New School recently, and there's a 48,000 University of California workers striking puts, you know, it adds a little bit more relevance to the idea that there is a perception of folks involved in higher education as being workers.
Absolutely. And there was this very interesting account a few months ago in the New York Times of the role of young people with a college degree or at least some years of college, the role they played in organizing unions at Amazon, at Starbucks. There are people who've been at some college who might have expected to be somewhere else and are working as baristas and are organizing unions. This is kind of extraordinary. This is not the way we usually think of, you know, how these things happen.
So let me ask you, as a final question, which is a much broader one. What is the value, or I guess the role of of theory in the context of these things, of these struggles, because I'm curious as to how much like theory is important in these type of struggles, and like how broadly shared or how broadly embraced must be theory and interest in theory and awareness of theory in these type of, you know, responses to these crises, and, you know, in determining whether it's developmental or epochal in terms of the changes.
Right. I guess I want to think about theory for the purpose of this question in a very simple way. I would just say theory is about connecting the dots, right? It's about showing why Black Lives Matter activists and Me Too activists and Starbucks unionizers and New School adjuncts and so on, why they actually have a lot more in common, or at least share some of the same enemies, than might become apparent at first glance. It doesn't have to be stated in an arcane, academically precise way. I try to state it in an arcane, academically precise way. But if ideas like that filter out and become part of the common sense of our time, so that people connect the dots, they understand that what connects us is not simply sense the feeling of affinity with people like us, but an impersonal system that is cannibalizing all of us. Then I think our political possibilities suddenly expand in a very positive way. That's what I think the role of theory is. It gives people narratives or accounts that helps them connect dots, get a bigger sense of who their allies are, and a sharper sense of who their enemies are.
So its value is determined by its function in increasing solidarity.
At the most practical level, yes. I think that there are also beautiful intellectual benefits to be had from theory. But yes, at this level, yes, expanding solidarity to the point where you might actually be able to create a political force that is powerful enough and visionary enough to change things in a way that would vastly improve all of our lives.
Nancy Fraser, professor of political and social science at the New School for Social Research. The book is Cannibal Capitalism, How Our System is Devouring Democracy, Care, and the Planet, and What We Can Do About It. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been very enjoyable. Pleasure.
Thanks, Nancy.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half of the program. Hmm. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, you get the fun half too. And you also get some special bennies on the app. You can IM the show via the new and improved iOS app and soon to be new and improved Android app.
Bennies, you say?
Sorry. Oh my God. I was wondering what you were doing. I could see you wind up for that. Because look at what's going on with Matt right now. Because you got into like completely.
What is that?
That's Jordan Peterson going Benzo. And I saw you out of the corner of my eye, like just like you really inhabited him. You just got like
I got in the defensive stance.
So. Yeah, you got like something was going on with your face, and I was wondering what was going on there. Like you were super suspect of what I was saying. It's hilarious. Yes, there are bennies available, like you can IM from the app, and you can check that out. I've completely lost my train of thought now. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. You get 10% off. Oh, you have one more day. This is it. It's got to be in by tomorrow morning. If you have a late-breaking best of suggestion. We're not going to take all your suggestions, but we're going to filter them out and take the best ones. We're sort of like, it's like a poll, like Elon Musk would do, right?
Right.
We will accept.
Vox Populi.
Okay. And Posit says, is today's interview eligible for 2022 best of? That is a great question. No.
2023.
So put that in on January 2nd. Send in best of. That way we can go back. But. Which means that December guests and even late November of 2021 are eligible for the 2022 best of. That's the way we do it. The best of year does not line up with the calendar year. Just like the fiscal year for some entities do not.
Gotcha.
We have a best of year that goes basically from mid-November to November. If you check the bylaws of your a Majority Report membership, you will see what I'm talking about. We make you sign an extended document when you become a member that involves a non-disclosure form and, of course, a complete fealty to the bylaws of the Majority Report.
Naturally.
So, of course. Meanwhile, far less onerous is the is ESVN.
No.
You don't have to You don't have to sign any of those documents.
You do not. It's a free entry into the ESVN family. If you choose to subscribe, youtube.com/ESVN show. We're going to have a fun show today because that was a fun World Cup. And that was an insane.
That World Cup was amazing.
And it was an insane weekend for the NFL. Like, yeah, record.
2 days of football, Saturday and Sunday. Crazy.
The Vikings just broke
games.
The record for the largest comeback in NFL history. We'll be breaking that down, as well as my Giants winning a must-win last night to stay in the playoff race. Patriots, like, choking. I don't know if that's worse than the butt fumble. I also will go in on Robert Saleh, who I think is a bit of a pretender. YouTube.com/ESVN show.
Check it out, folks. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian Media Enterprise Zone?
Yes, for that left
that opportunity zone.
We had Kelsey Atherton of who writes on military technology to discuss this fusion breakthrough at Lawrence Livermore Labs and how the motive for the research is actually sort of apocalyptic nuclear weapons testing.
Good things can come out of total annihilation of the human race.
Yeah, a little bit of a double-edged sword there. And we also talked about the funny F-35 crash in Texas and what the F-35 means. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning to get access to that.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. We will see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. 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 Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare.
Bring back DJ Dan.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dan.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See, white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100.
Can't knock the hustle.
Come on. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on.
To pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.